I'm curious, Corey, what does thinking about a realistic apprenticeship actually mean? And did you do it?
That is a great question. Yes, I did. And the problem that I have is I can't get to a realistic one at this stage in my life. So I can get to realistic ones if I was 20 or, you know, whatever that might be. But with me having a full-time job, having a family, being essentially committed to this location, committed to the Denver area, like it's just realistic is what makes that word or makes that action item really kind of challenging. Because I've explored, I'm like, well, what if I did a virtual one? You know, like, could I do a virtual, you know, internship or a virtual apprenticeship with somebody? And it's like, yes, I think I could, but I just don't think I'd want to do that. Like, I don't think that's as interesting to me. So I've got a couple people identified. I'm intentionally not going to say them. But I've got a couple people that are identified. It's a matter of time, and it's a matter of, is this the right season for that to happen? And I just don't think it is. I don't think doing an apprenticeship right now is the right season. Unless I could tie it into work. Like if I could tie it into my work day, sure. Or if I could tie it into something that I'm doing already, sure. The one way I would extend this to think about it that I thought, well, if I stop thinking about it as like a full year or a 5 year or a 7 year or whatever it is, and I think about it as like, can I do a shorter, essentially internship? That's why I messed up and said the word internship, right? If I thought about it as an internship for like the summer, that gets more realistic. Like that gets much more realistic to do as a shorter period of time. I just think I lose some of the aspects of the mastery because you need that longer period of time and that kind of deep connection with the person.
Yeah, when you were talking about this, like I am interested in the concept, but I have trouble picturing a scenario where you would actually disconnect from like the day-to-day and seek out an actual apprenticeship. That feels like something that has to be done in a very specific season of life.
I would agree completely. I would agree completely. And I don't think this season is right for me right now.
Cool. I like the concept though. And we talked about this last time, but the whole concept of the mini apprenticeships is really interesting to me. I guess plug for reading books in that role. Yeah. Obviously as a co-host of a podcast that talks about reading books, I would say that, but just reiterate that plug. There's lots of good books out there. Lots of great information from some of the best minds the world has ever seen. And if you pick one up and you don't like it, unlike us, because we have to record a podcast about it, you don't have to finish it.
Exactly. Well, and I'll say, Mike, pay attention and keep following up with me on this, because there's a really good chance that, you know, I start talking about something and you're like, Corey, this sounds like a mini internship. It sounds like you're trying to do a mini internship with this individual or a mini apprenticeship with this individual. And I'd be like, oh yeah, I think I might be trying to do that. So let's see if this is one of those things that stews in the background and simmers in the background and then emerges something.
All right.
Else.
I will try to catch you in an inadvertent mini apprenticeship.
Yes. Yes. Do that. And you didn't have any follow-up items. You didn't have any action items from the last book. Are you holding to that? Is there anything that came out of mastery that you thought about?
Well, I thought about lots of stuff with mastery, but no additional action items from it. Have been busy though, so I'm not sure I would have gotten around to my action items anyways, because okay. I do have one thing I want to mention here, and that is that the next Life Theme cohort is kicking off on Wednesday, April 26th. I'm getting my dates mixed up. I checked my watch here real quick and then I got completely confused. April 24th.
Okay. Yeah, that makes more sense.
Yeah. So by the time this goes out, it will have already started, but the thing that you will have missed is just the introductory kickoff call and then kind of the preliminary stuff where we talk about kind of the moments of impact. All of the sessions are going to be recorded, and I really should have mentioned this at the previous episode, so I apologize for that for anybody who is interested in this sort of thing. If this one does not work, then you can wait and we will do another one. However, the price basically just keeps going up with this. So the last one was $197. This one is $297. If you are a member of the library, which is my community that Corey has given me a push to actually launch now, then there's a discount for the cost that you paid for your library membership. So that brings it down to the previous price. It includes six live coaching calls, essentially group coaching calls, which all happen on Wednesdays at 10 a.m. Central Time. So that's 11 a.m. Eastern and 8 a.m. Pacific. My wife and I will both be doing it together. Some of the feedback I got last time was that people liked Rachel more than they liked me, which I'm totally good with. She does an awesome job, and it's great to have her perspective in this. It really makes the experience a lot better. So it includes access to a specific area in the community where all of the discussion and all the events take place. And basically it's 6 weeks where we talk through the different steps of a life theme, identifying your moments of impact, thinking bigger, creating an image, identifying core values, and condensing all of that down into a personal life theme. And then the last week is really the cool one where we all get on a call and we share our life theme as a result of the process. Some of those are pretty emotional, but they're always really, really fun. It's always great to hear other people share their life themes. And it's really cool, just kind of the camaraderie that gets built in this group over the 6 weeks. It's a very authentic, vulnerable, caring group of people. You know, we're talking about some personal stuff as you're identifying for yourself, like, what is my life going to be about? Doesn't matter what stage of life you're at. We've got people in there who are like just out of college, people in there who are retired in their 70s. And they all kind of say the same thing, that this was a really valuable experience. And even if you decide not to do the life theme cohort, you know, I encourage everyone to think about what is the life I want to live? How do I live out my vision and my values in a practical way? And if you want some help with that, then you can go to mikeschmitz.com/life theme, get more details. With the $297, you get a year of access to the library, which that's the $100 a year. You get access also to the personal retreat course, and then I've bundled both of my journaling courses together now into one course for journaling for personal growth. So that was the journaling bootcamp and the digital journaling in Obsidian, but those are basically just two different sections now in that journaling course, and all of that is in the library. So if that sounds like something you'd be interested in, we would love to have you join us.
So I have a question about the follow-up. What's the status of the reading workshop?
Reading workshop, as we record this, is happening on Friday. And okay. I am getting terrified because there are about 40 people who have signed up.
Congrats. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's definitely more than I anticipated. I won't say it's more than I hoped for, obviously, but I was kind of bracing myself. Like, first one I've done like this, like, what if only five people sign up? But I was playing the long game anyways with this. I want to start doing these more frequently. So it was kind of like, well, let's figure out the process, deliver an awesome workshop, and then make it better for next time. But yeah. Bunch of folks going to be there, and it's coming together. It's going to be awesome. But the more people that sign up, the more pressure I put on myself to make it awesome.
Yeah, you're going to do great. You're going to do great. I mean, that's right in your wheelhouse, you know, with all the other stuff you do. So it's going to be awesome. I'm glad you had that much response. That's fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, I will I don't know exactly how it's going to work, but I will figure out a way if people are listening to this and they missed the workshop and they want to buy the replay. I'll figure out a way to do that and put the link in the show notes for people who are interested. All right, ready to talk about today's book?
I am.
Okay, so today's book is Super Communicators by Charles Duhigg, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. And as I told you, when I saw this in the airport as we were traveling back from our family vacation in Florida, I was like, oh, that looks interesting. And then I was like, oh, Charles Duhigg. Was not a fan of The Power of Habit.
Why? Can you remind me why? Like, what was the...
Yeah. Well, I don't think the book itself necessarily was bad, but the more distance I get from that habit loop, I think it's wrong.
Okay.
And not like wrong in every sense, but just not a helpful model. Like James Clear's model, where he interjects the step between the cue and the routine, is a really important one. And BJ Fogg, Tiny Habits, talks about like why we follow through with that temptation or we're able to resist it. There's different factors at play there. So I just didn't like the feeling of anytime you're exposed to a cue, the routine's going to happen. You're a rat in a cage, like nothing you can do about it.
Okay.
So, yeah, I feel like that book was kind of held up for a long time as like the habit book. I think Atomic Habits has kind of replaced that. I think Atomic Habits is like the most successful self-help book ever, is what I heard. And I don't remember the exact statistics about like how many copies it sold, but it's been at the top of the bestseller list for like years now at this point. So definitely like that one better. All that to say, like, had that taste in my mouth when I saw another Charles Duhigg book, I was a little bit skeptical. So
okay. Yeah,
just there's some history there, I guess. But I actually really enjoyed this book. It wasn't, you know, exactly what I thought it was going to be. It is very much cut from the same cloth as The Power of Habit. So I'm not sure what I expected to be different here. Like, you can kind of see the formula that he's following here. Just to talk through the structure of the book quickly, there are the three kinds of conversations. That's the kind of the first section. There's no like official parts, but that's the first part. And then in there is a chapter, which is the matching principle, and then a guide to using these ideas, part one. The next section is the what's this really about conversation. There's chapter two, and then a guide to using these ideas, part two. Then the next part is the how do we feel conversation. This has chapter three, the listening cure. Chapter four, how do you hear emotions no one says aloud. Chapter five, connecting amid conflict. And then again, a guide to using these ideas, part three. You're seeing a theme here, probably. The last part is the who are we conversation. Has another couple chapters. Chapter six, our social identities shape our worlds. Chapter seven, how do we make the hardest conversation safer. And then, of course, a guide to using these ideas. Now, the guides to using these ideas are basically summaries of the main points from the chapters, but I do like how it's kind of packaged at the end, like, here's how you actually apply this. And then there's an afterword at the very end, kind of like an outro at the end of the book. So it's a little bit more interesting, at least layout-wise, than the standard three-part productivity book, but it definitely follows kind of that format. Now, the topic of super communicators, I think, is kind of interesting too. I don't know that the theme I had in my head when I heard super communicators was exactly the model that he talks about in this book. I guess, what were your first impressions going into this before we dive into the meat?
I was actually glad you said that, because I thought the same thing. Like, what I expected, and I'm talking just looking at the title and the front page, not reading the back of the book or not reading any of the blurbs or anything like that. I don't know. I was not expecting it to be this, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe it, like lay level, like normal person level. Like, I was expecting it to be like, oh, we're going to talk about the expert skills of expert 100%, you know, like communicators. And they were getting these examples of these big names or whatever it was. And it was not like that at all. It's much more research based. And it was much more like, how can you, oh, normal person, be a super communicator, which just wasn't what I was thinking going into it. I liked it. It didn't bother me. It was just very different. So I was glad to actually hear you say that, because that caught me off guard a little bit.
Yeah, it's also interesting. Like, at the beginning, he kind of talks about why he got into this topic. And it was basically because as someone in a leadership position, he realized he wasn't very good at communicating. So there's definitely a big dose of humility that is sprinkled in here. On the one hand, that's good. I feel like I connect more with the people who are authentic about the struggles that they're going through. On the other hand, when you pick up a book like this, you probably want to get it from someone who like lives this stuff and has been doing it for 40 years. Yeah. At least I think that's the general inclination. I think that isn't not necessarily the right approach with this particular book. You know, just the fact that he was researching this stuff to solve a problem that he had does not disqualify him or diminish the value of the things that he is sharing in this book at all. But it's also interesting because as we go through here, I feel like there's another angle to this that he is sort of touching on, but not really addressing. So there's an open loop for you. Let's talk about the three kinds of conversation here. Now, this is the first section in the book, and this is where he kind of lays out his model. But the three questions that we need to ask really align with these three different types of conversations. So it's really, what's this really about? The decision-making mindset. How do we feel? The emotional mindset. And then who are we, which is the social mindset, the identity mindset. All based on this concept of the matching principle, which is recognizing what kind of conversation is occurring and then matching the other person. Now, I had heard about this matching concept before. He gets a little bit at the very beginning into the concept of neurological synchronization, the alignment of our brains and our bodies. So an example of that would be like if you and I are walking down the street together and we're talking, you're walking a little bit faster than I am, I will kind of match your pace. Mm-hmm. And I won't think about it. It'll just kind of happen. But there's a whole bunch of things like that happen when we try to communicate with someone. And so a lot of times miscommunication happens when people have different kinds of conversations. I can totally see that.
Yeah.
The guide to using these ideas, I think we'll probably skip over these for most of these sections, and we'll just kind of tackle it section by section. So as it pertains to the three kinds of conversations here, what stands out to you, Corey?
Yeah, so first, I had never thought about conversations in this way. So when I read this, was the first I'd been exposed to, well, are we truly trying to figure something out, like a practical decision-making type of thing? Is there some underlying emotion where we're actually, what we're talking about isn't really relevant to anything? And then is this identity thing? I think these are three good ones. I don't think they encompass everything though. So I think there's more. I haven't had the chance to unpack like what the other ones would be, but I just think that like I'm really good on the practical decision-making one because I have a lot of experience with that one. So it's like, okay, we're planning tomorrow. You know, like what do we need to do? We need to solve problems. We need to get practical. We need to figure that out. And boom, that's the whole nature of the conversation. I'm really good with the emotional one because I know that there are times when like I either want to tell you something like I just did earlier. I don't remember where it was in the recording thing. It's like basically I just wanted to tell you a thing just because it was like I just wanted to tell you the thing, man. Like it really, we weren't going to make any decisions out of it. We didn't have anything. It was like this is weighing on me and I need to tell you and I don't know what I want to know that. So like I see that all the time as well. The social one is where it maybe I'm just different, right? Because I don't know, like I feel like I don't have as many of these conversations, so that one was a little more of a stretch for me. And maybe I have them more and I just didn't realize it. But then I think there's some other ones and I have to like figure out where they would sit in there. So it's like an example I can give you that, again, I haven't flushed these out fully, right? There's a sales conversation. And like, where does a sales conversation sit into that, right? Because I'm going to pull some practical decision-making out of it because I want you to make a decision out of this conversation. I'm going to pull some emotion into that. But in my mind, it's a very different conversation, right? Like I have a goal or an objective with that sales conversation. And the part of the reason why this like comes to the top of my head is like, I know, Mike, if you came to me and I know you're a salesperson and you're trying to sell me new windows on my house, for my house, I approach that conversation very, very, very differently than I approach a practical, emotional, or a social conversation. And it's like, so I think there are some other ones that weren't unpacked that could be unpacked. I would have to think hard about what they are. That was my first take on the three. I liked them, but I think there's some other things.
That's interesting. I never thought about that, but you're right. These sales conversations specifically, you know, based on my limited knowledge of marketing, would combine a couple of these. Mm-hmm. So maybe these three distinctions make sense, and then kind of a conversation can be more than one of these potentially.
And it could be that like these are the base layer.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so these, when you get down to the most fundamental, these are the base layer, and all other conversations that are more specific have a portion of these three, and we have to think about what portion of those and when are we using those. Because, you know, I mean, I go back to the sales thing. I think about a sales one, there's going to be a time when I'm going to try to pull on your emotions more. There's going to be a time where I'm going to try to identify with you more and share in that identity. Then there's going to be a time where I'm trying to get you to make a decision, and I'm trying to like, essentially. So I can see them all playing into there. But overall, I mean, I think it's a good foundation to build on. The other thing that you had brought up earlier, the matching principle, I had never heard this before in my life. So this makes sense to me. Like, it's logical and it's intuitive that we're going to align on some level, and the less aligned we are, the more potential conflict there is in the conversation. Mm-hmm. But I had never thought about it. And especially from a communication standpoint, I'd never really thought about that before.
Yeah. It's definitely a thing, but I think you got to be careful with it too, because the whole term super communicator applies to people who are able to synchronize effortlessly with just about anyone. But he does mention that you can take this too far, where people know that you are really trying to get in sync.
Yeah.
And then it's just awkward.
Yeah, and it's super awkward, right? Like, I mean, I'm sure there's somebody that popped into your mind and my mind and the listener's mind and all that stuff where it's like, man, I know that person who's tried a little too hard in this area. Oh, I just thought of one more thing. So one other thing out of the prologue that I thought was interesting, and I wanted him to talk more about it throughout the book, but he kind of hits it at the beginning and then there's really nothing, and then he hits it at the end. But it's this learning conversation. Right. Specifically, we want to learn how the people around us see the world and help them to understand our perspective in turn. I really like this idea of the learning conversation, and I wanted more of that. And we just we didn't get it. Now, like, maybe the argument is, well, all, you know, seven chapters was how to get to this learning conversation. But I wanted that to be explicit, more explicit throughout the book.
Yeah, there are definitely like pieces of this that fit together, but he doesn't package it, and I'm actually thankful for this, as like, here's the model, boom, everything you need to know. So I think that's probably the issue, at the root of the issue I had with The Power of Habit, is like, boom, here it is, everything revolves around this cycle. Okay. But there's so many ways where like that mental model doesn't work. That's the beauty of mental models, is like, you have to develop the skill to know when to use them, and yada yada yada. More mental models later, potentially. The other thing with this, which I think is interesting, in the guide to using these ideas, he offers four basic rules of a learning conversation, which these pop up throughout the book. So he doesn't specifically say the learning conversations, but he refers to these rules pretty consistently. So pay attention to what kind of conversation is occurring. Share your goals and ask what others are seeking. Ask about others' feelings and share your own. Exploration of identities are important to the discussion. And then the other thing, which I thought was pretty brilliant, is based on the three types of conversations here, there's the do you want to be. I feel like I should totally use this. In fact, I think I need to add this as an action item right now.
I'm not remembering this, so remind me the what you're talking about here.
Okay, so there's a section where he says, do you want to be helped, hugged, or heard? So essentially, the helped, that's the what's this about conversation. Hugged, that's the how do we feel conversation. And heard, that's the who are we conversation. And I feel like this, I mean, my wife and I, a lot of the conversations that we have, we definitely fall into this stereotype where like she's telling me something and I'm immediately going into, well, we got to fix this. And she's like, no, I just want to tell you.
Yep.
So when he explained it this way, I was like, oh, I go into my default is the do you want to be helped conversation, when maybe she's asking that she wants to be hugged or heard instead. Like, mm-hmm. acknowledge mm-hmm. the emotions, or just acknowledge that like this is how you're feeling about something. So I feel like that phrase, like that single sentence, could kind of be that could be really powerful. It's like, okay, so just let's align here. What kind of conversation are we having? And essentially, like, she doesn't have to do anything. It's on me. Like, do you want to be helped, hugged, or hurt? If we have the shared definitions of what these things are, then like that could maybe make streamline the communication a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other places that you could use that, obviously, but that's the one that comes to mind in day-to-day life for me.
Yeah. So one of the questions I have is, do you do this, Mike? Like, do you try to, and when I say this, I mean, do you try to like synchronize with the people you're interacting with? And I mean it like the way he describes it, right? Like, so super communicators know how to evoke synchronization by encouraging people to match how they are communicating, right? Like, so basically, and then he unpacks like kind of how to do that. Do you actively try to do this, reflecting on conversations you have with people and, you know, the way you approach a conversation?
I don't think I actively do this, but I totally do this.
Okay.
And I do it more, I feel, in conversations with people that I don't have a real strong bond or connection with.
Mm.
I feel like the people that I'm closest with, I don't, and I'm just like talking out loud, I'm not consciously choosing this, but it's almost like with them, I don't have to be on my guard. I don't have to work so hard. Like, I know they just accept me. So there isn't the necessity to create the connection. But if it's somebody that like, I don't want it to be socially awkward or whatever, then I find myself, like he talked about these cues where you'll try to, if someone says something funny, you may laugh a little bit. I do that all the time. And then I have to catch myself because I was like, wait a second. Like, I don't actually think that's funny. Why am I doing this? Yeah. Because I'm projecting that they are trying to make a joke and I'm trying to connect with them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Because the reason I asked the question is because I think I do some of these things, but I don't think I intentionally do them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was surprising to me. It's like, it's not like I sit down and I think, oh, well, right now I'm going to ask active questions or, you know, intentionally try to dig deeper into this topic. But I do that. Like especially when I'm feeling, and I think I do it out of more of a silence bothers me. So therefore, like if you and I are talking and I don't know you very well, I'll ask you a bunch of questions because I don't want it to be uncomfortable. And a way for me to make it not uncomfortable is to ask you a bunch of questions because then I feel like somebody's moving the conversation forward.
Yeah.
But he would say it's for a different area. So I think we might be digressing a little bit. So you may want to move us where you want
no,
us to
go. I like the conversation though. It does kind of lead into the what's this really about conversation. So let's go there because the what's this really about conversation is a negotiation he talks about. That's the chapter title. And recognizing that every conversation is a negotiation, I feel like is one of the big takeaways. But then the other thing that really stands out to me from this section is that two kinds of logic exist side by side in our brain. And this is kind of to the point you were just talking about. I feel like we're constantly trying to find the balance here when we are in a conversation. The logic of costs and benefits. So is this a practical discussion? And in that, if that's the case, then we tend to lean into data and reasoning. The other one is the logic of similarities. Is this an empathetic discussion where we lean into stories and compassion? By the way, as part of the prologue, I think it was, that's where he shared the story about the jury. And he walks through the masterful job that the Marquette University professor, because there's like very adamant people on both sides and he's trying to like get out of there as quickly as he can. So he practices all of the things that Charles Duhigg is talking about in this book to make everybody feel heard and create alignment because they have to all agree. So he's got to change somebody's mind essentially. And it's not this conversation or this practical, you know, data and reasoning piece that is what aligns people. So every conversation being a negotiation and, you know, what is this really about? I think that my takeaway from this is that it's never just one of these things. There's always a balance, and the really good business meetings that I've been a part of, you've got to be able to go back and forth between these. Yeah. It's kind of weird to me. Like I wish You could just, let's talk about the facts. Let's make the decisions based on the data. But literally every organization I've been a part of, they say like, oh yeah, well, we're going to take the emotional piece out of it, and nobody can.
Yeah, nobody can. Yeah.
Nobody can.
He hits that really hard about how like basically emotion is the underpinning of everything.
Yeah.
And I don't remember if it's in this chapter or if it's in a different chapter, but I mean, he hits that really hard. One of the things, so this is the robot in me, right? Mm-hmm. I'll say it that way. Like, I want to walk into every conversation and I want to say, what is the purpose of this conversation, right? Like, let's figure that out right now before we even move on. So it's like, if we're trying to make a decision, let's say we're trying to make a decision right now. If you just want to be heard, tell me that right now. That way I know coming into this, like, but you can't do that. And like, I wish you could, because like, it makes the conversation so robotic. But like, man, if we could walk with like a sign on the front of us that says, this conversation is about deciding what I want to eat for breakfast. Right? And it's like, or this conversation is just wanting you to know that I'm hungry. Like, like, I wish my kids could do this when they came downstairs. I feel like it would ease so much of the stuff. So you had said about how it's like a really important, I think this concept is really important, this negotiation concept. I agree with you completely. Like, I think this is one where I wish I could make it more straightforward. I don't think I can. So I have to figure out how to, in a nuanced way, make it more front end of every conversation. And I mean, well, I know we weren't going to really hit the guide all that much, but he does give four steps for this, right? So we'll unpack those for a second. So he says, prep for the conversation, ask open-ended questions, notice the clues, and then experiment with new items or new topics as a way to figure out, well, what are we really talking about here?
Yeah.
Right? Because I've been in so many conversations where you realize 20 minutes into the meeting, 25 minutes into the meeting, it's like, oh, this has nothing to do with what I thought it was, what I thought we were talking about. You really want this other thing out of this conversation. And now we can go from there.
Yeah. I'm glad you called out the four ways we share our goals and ask what others are seeking. That's the part from A Guide to Using These Ideas, part two. Because I have in my mind map file here, those four different steps, and then the questions that he gives underneath those, which I think are all really good. So if you're just going into this book and you want like the Blinkist version, and how do I like start deploying this right away? You just read those sections. It's like 5 to 10 pages at the end of the section. And like, here's what you use. And those lists of questions, I feel like those are great resources. That's why I captured them all into my mind map file. But I could definitely see myself going back and looking at those and using those. And it's kind of interesting because like, you have an agenda by using those questions, but it's in service of the other person. So it doesn't feel manipulative. Because the big takeaway for me from this section, you know, we talked about every conversation is a negotiation, but negotiation isn't a battle. It's an act of creativity, he says. And the best negotiators don't focus on getting the biggest piece of the pie. They make the pie bigger.
Make the pie bigger. Yep.
And when I read that, like, that makes sense. I want to do that. And immediately I felt regret for like all these flashbacks came to mind of like, conversations and arguments with the family business because we're trying to make this decision, you know, and it's really clear in my mind, like, this is the way to go. Like, one that comes to mind is when I was working with the family business, I was involved with the development team and we were trying to decide, we're moving from like installable software to an online program. And the easy way to do it is just, well, just build it in Flash. It was still going to be like millions of dollars to move everything over, but that was the easy way. And I was like, no, this iPod stuff and the iPad, like, this is a big deal for special education and Flash is never going to run on this. Like, we got to do it in web standards, HTML, CSS. And there were lots of, shall we say, spicy conversations. And I think, you know, if you're trying to choose somebody who was right, technically I was right. Flash was not a good long-term investment there. But I also recognize my perspective going into those conversations was like, we have to make the right decision. And like, I had to fight for the right decision. And if I would have had this mindset, I'm sure there were ways where those conversations could have gone a lot smoother because I could have still gotten what I wanted, you know, let's build this using new web technologies, and allowed other people to get some wins as well.
Yeah.
But that just wasn't my mindset back then.
Yep. I understand that completely. I've been in many of those conversations where you look back on it and you're like, man, I just, that one wasn't the way it could have gone, right? You know, it could have gone in a little bit of a different way. I think, so this, he introduces a concept here called back channeling as well, or an idea called back channeling, which I had not heard it referred to this as before, but I do this all the time. And I think this is what makes internet communication somewhat challenging. And if you've ever been on a call where there's lag on the Zoom call or Skype or whatever it is, man, it really throws off the conversation because you can't get that feedback, the uh-huh, the that's interesting, the wow, like I never had any idea. But this is also an area, right, to let people, you know, into the podcasting world. This is an area where I struggle with podcasting because, like, I want to say that when you're when you're saying something, I would be like, uh-huh, yeah, great, right? But from an editor's standpoint, man, it's terrible. Like, you don't want the other person adding in these little things, because if you get your time sync off slightly, you get, those things can get messed up. But it's so important to the conversation that, like, I couldn't help but think of that, like, oh, back channeling. Like, is it better in the conversation between Mike and I for me to throw in those uh-huhs, that interesting, and risk talking over him? Or is it better to just be quiet and just nod so he can see the nonverbal back channel, but at the same time there's no, you know, there's no there. And then I think it feels somewhat artificial, right, to the listener. If you don't ever hear from the other person and there's like a 2 minute, 2.5 minute, you know, diatribe from the other, it's like, man, did the other person fall asleep? Like, where'd they go? But it really has to do with editing. That's the major driver of it.
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to call that out too, back channeling, which is making noises as you listen to indicate that you're following along. And you're right. Like, from an editing perspective, that can be a nightmare. So this is one of the areas where you have to learn this as you podcast, I feel. And I probably err a little bit too much on the side of I do this frequently. When you're listening to a podcast, I mean, it kind of depends on the podcast, I guess, but like, I'm thinking about Mac Power Users as an example. David and Steven do a really good job, and maybe they edit this to this point, but they almost never interrupt people, right? Never interrupt each other. But I feel like the standard approach to this is, for a podcaster, when you are going to jump in with something, you just jump in all the way and you just say it. And that feels weird too, because then you at least have, if you got separate tracks, the editor can splice it together and make it sound like it was cleaner than it was. But it's when you start to jump in and the other person, go ahead. Like, that's the really messy stuff from an editing perspective, having done editing myself. Yes,
I agree.
That's so hard to learn. I know Jason Snell's talked about that with the Incomparable podcast that he does with like the 12 different people, because they're always talking over each other. And I forget where I heard him talk about it, but basically like people just let it rip and then it's up to him in the edit to like clean it all up. And that sounds like so much work.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah, so where's that sweet spot? Let's go to the next section, which is the how do we feel conversation. And this one has a couple different chapters, a couple different models. There's a lot in here, basically. So let me just run down the chapters quick. Chapter 3, The Listening Cure. Chapter 4, How Do You Hear Emotions No One Says Aloud? Chapter 5, Connecting Amid Conflict. And then again, the guide to using these ideas. Now, the listening cure, let's start there. And we can just kind of talk about these ideas together. We don't have to go chapter by chapter. But I want to start with this first one, because right at the beginning of this chapter, he uses a phrase here, which I think ties back to the comment you made about the different types of conversations, like a sales conversation. And do you have like conversations that span these different categories? I think this is where the answer is yes, because he says, there often comes a moment when you have to decide, will I allow this conversation to turn emotional? So that to me communicates that a conversation could have ebbs and flows, or it could evolve as you go through it. And maybe if you were to plot these out, you've got different levels, right? And so the very base level is the what's the decision to be made here. But then if you're going to go deeper or higher, you know, depending how you organize these different levels, I guess, the next place that you could go is to this emotional level. And he talks about how emotions are already influencing your conversations. They influence everything that we say in here, which is kind of interesting. And this reminded me of, there's a book that we covered for Bookworm a while back called Liminal Thinking. And I will probably refer to this book in every episode that we do from this from today forward. Like, I bring it up all the time because it was so impactful for me, because he has this like this diagram where you've got at the bottom level like everything that's knowable, and then you've got your experience on top of that, and then your experience, really there's only like a small percentage of the information that comes in into your senses that you can actually pay attention to, and on top of that you build all your judgments, all your beliefs, and you surround yourself with people who look, talk, and act just like you do. So you have this bubble belief that reinforces like all these preconceived notions about how things are. But what the takeaway from that book is essentially we need to seek out conversations with people who have different perspectives. So if you're seeking out conversations, people have different perspectives, I can guarantee you that things are going to get emotional.
Yes, yes.
Especially, you know, when you attach your identity, which is the next level here, so we won't go there quite yet, but like that's really at the root of a lot of this stuff too. Yes. Is like, why do I have emotions tied to this? Because I see myself a specific way. And so if you have different thoughts about things, that can feel like an attack on myself. It can make me feel uncomfortable. It can make me feel threatened. And when you're talking about that, I mean, if you're trying to get to any level of depth with the conversation, it's like, well, yeah, obviously, of course, you've got to talk about that stuff. You can't just let it like fester in the background. One of the things I love from this section, by the way, is the fast friends method that he mentioned. Okay, so these are 36 questions that they use to like get people from total strangers to I'm going to invite you to my wedding, essentially. I'll let you kind of talk about that. I see you pumping your fist about the fast friends method.
Yeah. So I was super, super jazzed about this because he starts going through this and I'm like, man, I want to use these. Like, I really want to use these. I want to figure out, does this work? So what he says by these is there are 36 questions that encourage people to get vulnerable, right? So make that emotional connection. It ties into the matching principle. It ties into reciprocity and then like acknowledging someone's emotions and then showing them that you care from it. And that it was like effective in increasing closeness. And if you look this up, like there's a bunch of different things that you'll find online if you just do a Google search. But it actually has seemed to change names somewhat to 36 questions for increasing closeness. Okay. is what it is now. But I want to go through these with someone, right? Like I just want to see what they're like and see, because the way he sells it so well in the story that he tells and like in how effective it was that I'm just like, man, if this thing works, that would be amazing. So it seeds these quote unquote, right questions that allow people to get vulnerable, that allow this emotional contagion thing to happen, which allows this connection to happen. And this was really, really interesting to me. And I almost want to like force people to go through this and just see if it works effectively. But, you know, like that could be, you know, people may not like me for quote unquote forcing them to do that. But if I was the manager of somebody or like a group of people, I'd be like, okay, hey, we're going to do this activity today where I'm going to put you in pairs and we're going to go through these 36 questions.
Yeah. Well, I was reading this book on the airplane and I found the list in the appendix. So I jotted them all down in my mind map. I also would like to do that. So I think we just found our first member special.
Nice. That's amazing. Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And I don't think you necessarily need these questions, but they are very well done questions. One of the things that kind of stands out to me from that whole section is that you can create emotional connection by asking deep questions and reciprocating vulnerability. This is something that I do when I am with a group of people that I'm not super close with. I'm the guy who, when we are at dinner, I'll just throw out a random deep question and wait for somebody to answer it. And everyone's like, wait, I don't know you. Why are you asking me this? And just like sit there till we create like really meaningful conversation.
Give me an example of one of these questions.
Well, okay. So one that comes to mind is there's this conference that we go to for the men's group, my church, every year. And after the evening session, we go to this restaurant. And there was a bunch of other people who were kind of like in a somewhat related group to us, but not really. They're from the conference. We kind of know who they are, but like we just met them. It's not like we're best friends. We've hung out together outside of this setting ever. So we sit down, and one of the things the speaker is talking about is like related to purpose and vision and values. So like I'm the life theme guy, right? Let's just jump right in there. So like, hey, so this guy was talking about this, you know, what's your personal core values? Or that's not exactly what it was, but I remember like it was something really like, who are you? You know, what's important to you sort of a thing. And the guy I was asking to is just like, you know, deer in the headlights. Like, you're really asking me this? But, you know, I love that kind of stuff because once you get over the initial awkwardness, it's meaningful.
Yeah.
And I enjoy having those conversations, even as an introvert. Like, that's not really my scene. I prefer not to be there doing that. But it's almost like a defense mechanism, like, oh, if I have to do this, like, let's at least get something out of it. Sounds terrible, but that's kind of
no, mindset. No, that makes total sense. So my version of this, the reason why I put you on the spot and I asked you this first is because my version of this is it's like a semi-deep question. So the one I like to do, it would be something along the lines of, okay, you just won the lottery. What's the first thing you buy and why?
That's a good one.
Because it's like, it's still fun, but it gets like deeper and you can still learn about people's values there, right? Like in terms of like how they feel about certain things. Or, you know, okay, you're on the first mission to Mars, you know, you're allowed to take two books. What are the two books you take why'd you pick those two? So it's like mine is, but I just like to be goofy. So that's half the reason why I like to do it is because I like to hear what people say and be like, that book was terrible. I would not take that book, you know?
Yeah, that's, so I've heard different versions of questions kind of like that. I feel like yours is kind of in the middle between like the super serious ones, which are usually the ones that I will lean towards. And then there's also like a whole group of just goofy ones. Like if you, I don't know, it's like that you give two extremes and like if you had to pick one or the other, which one would you pick? Like, I hate those.
if you could only eat one type of pizza for the rest of your life, would you, you know, pepperoni or sausage? It's like shut up. Like, why?
Yeah.
Oh man. Okay, so another part of this this chapter I like. So we're getting to how do we get to the feel conversation or the emotional thing. So he talks about the good ways to do this and kind of not so good ways to do this. So questions kind of governs the whole thing, but he says about this perspective taking. So when we try to see a situation from the other person's perspective and then show them we empathize, he said that's not the best way to connect. I tend to do that a lot. So I try to like see it from their perspective and then empathize with them. And sometimes it hits and sometimes it misses. So this resonated with me in terms of, that doesn't always work. The next one he would say is perspective getting. So asking people to describe their values, their beliefs, their feelings. And he said it's a better way to get that real understanding. He introduced the concept of emotional contagion, which I had never heard before, but that's synchronizing your own emotions with the emotions that like is being expressed around you, right? So how do I synchronize those things here? Now, one of the questions I have for you, Michael, on your mind map, do you have emotional contagion called out?
I do, yeah. It helps us bond, but it must be triggered by something. And then I've got the little wheel that he's got there. So,
okay. I don't have any follow-up to emotional contagion, right? Like, all I have is like the definition. Did he give any examples of like what this looks like in practice?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But kinda, I think, in the next couple chapters, because really the emotional contagion is sort of a weird term. In the next chapter, he talks about the NASA hiring approach.
Yep.
And how like the guy intentionally spills his papers when he walks in to see how people are going to respond. And essentially what he's describing there, I would frame it as they used to hire for the hard skills and now they're hiring for the soft skills. So another term there is emotional intelligence. And that, I've got a bunch of history with the family business. It's kind of weird to hear him kind of talk around that, but not really label it specifically. So when he's talking about emotional contagion and then that leads to the connection, I feel like that is emotional intelligence, which has many more facets than the few limited ones that he describes. And so this is the place where I feel like you see the fact that he's not very far along in this journey. That feels like a real logical next step for me, which unlocks a whole nother level of understanding in terms of how these conversations fit together. And I don't think it was intentional that like, okay, I got enough for my book, so 60,000 words, let's ship this thing. But it does show me that like you haven't gone deep enough yet. And maybe, you know, if he fully understood emotional intelligence, he interviewed Daniel Goleman and just like really comprehended this stuff, he would have chosen to ignore it anyways, because like the things that he talks about, how they fit together, I feel like that is very straightforward and very understandable. You don't want to complicate things to the level where people just they can't grok it anymore. Maybe emotional intelligence does do that. But this is like the spot where it's like, if you want to go deeper, this is the next thing.
Yeah.
And he doesn't make that leap. And I don't really blame him for that. I see this all the time, actually. People like start to discover emotional intelligence. They don't really know that it's emotional intelligence. And so like they don't make the connection there. But that's what empathy is. emotional intelligence. And that's the section that we're in, is like the whole emotional side of it. So really the conversations, you know, if I were to take a stab at like redoing the structure of this book, in this section for the emotional conversations, you've really got like two different types of conversations that happen in emotional intelligence. You've got intrapersonal communication, which is kind of the conversation that you're having with yourself. What are the stories that you're telling yourself? And that's where like positive self-talk comes in and stuff like that, because if you don't control that, you can just believe the story that your brain is telling you, you're a washed up pathetic loser and you're never going to do anything with your life. Like that's the way my voice talks if I don't don't deal with it. And then there's interpersonal, which is really what he's talking about in this book, where you're like you're managing all this stuff with other people. I do think that when you dig into like emotional intelligence, you've got different skills, like you mentioned sales earlier, with the emotional intelligence product that my dad developed this product with the family business that's got like 120 doctoral level papers and books written on it, 8.5 million uses, like the most research validated instrument in the world. So like he knows this stuff inside and out. And one of the scales I remember when I was growing up was like, that one's kind of weird. It's called sales orientation. Essentially it's leadership. Yeah. Like leadership is convincing people that you can get them where they want to go. And so I'll have conversations with people, be like, oh, I don't really like being salesy. Well, you're married, so you sold yourself at least once, right? Yeah, so there's like that whole aspect to it. And then there's a whole bunch of other scales. You know, empathy is a real important one. And when I have these conversations about this stuff, or this stuff pops up on my radar, I always want to go deeper and figure out how these pieces fit together. And that is not what you're going to get with this particular book, but I think that maybe is okay.
Yeah. I think part of the reason why you don't get that as much as you want to is because of the amount of work it's going to take to get there, right? Like, you're going to have to unpack a lot of different stuff. You know, you'd mentioned the papers and you mentioned all the different scales and all of that. And I think sometimes that isn't the crux. So therefore it's going to take too much time. So we hit the level that we can, which it, for you is like skipping a stone, you know, off the top of a pond. You want to dig in, see what's underneath that water, but it skips too much.
Yeah.
One of the things I liked about this, so we're in chapter 4, but one of the things I liked about the piece of emotional intelligence he did hit is this mood energy. And this lets me hit on a point that I like what he does in this book in terms of he summarizes in the guides, which we've already talked about, but he also summarizes in the like graphics and tables and different things. And I just think it's an effective way to give the same information, but in a different form. So you get to see it again, but you get to see maybe connections through it. So in this one, he's got energy on the y-axis. He's got mood on the x-axis. And then there's high and low and positive and negative, of course, respectively for those. And then he tells you like, okay, well, this is upbeat and this is angry and this is frustrated and whatever it is. And I like that it stood out to me, because if you've ever been in one of these conversations where you're, let's say, you know, like low energy, but you're positive, you're just not super, you know, happy that day. So yeah, everything's fine. Like, here I am. But you get somebody that's like super high energy, super positive, and you're just like, hold on. Like, you're like, whoa, speaker is too high right now. You gotta calm down a little bit. And like, I've found that, you know, there's been multiple times in my life where it's just, I want to just like reach over and just be like, can you please just turn it down? Like turn to a 7. You're at 11 right now. Like, I need you at a 7. So seeing it go wrong really like triggers that whole like, oh wow, like, yes, this is an important aspect to kind of match that energy and mood level with the people, not in an artificial way, but in a way that like, at least you're not out in, you know, left field and they're, you know, they're hanging out there going, wait, what are you doing right now? You're not even, you know, part of this context. So,
yeah. All right. Should we go to the last one?
Yep.
Okay, so the last type of conversation is the who are we conversation. There's a couple chapters here, and this one maybe is the most uncomfortable section in the book, because you can't really talk about this without acknowledging some pretty sensitive issues. Like, he opens this whole section with a story about a doctor who is trying to convince people with facts and figures that vaccines are safe. And he's realizing that it's having the opposite effect. And he's like, what the heck?
Yep.
Then they talk about how to have conversations between people of different types of groups. Like, there's a mom who was in a school shooting and then gets a text from her kid who is involved in a school shooting, like having a conversation through this experiment with somebody who is a complete Second Amendment, like owns multiple guns, come at me, bro. Like, I was uncomfortable just hearing about these scenarios. Race is another one that comes into play here. And I do think that the fact that it's uncomfortable is probably a good thing. I feel like these conversations do need to happen. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's a whole lot here, though, in terms of like, here's exactly how to do it. I think like if there's one section where you really can't just like follow a blueprint, it's probably this one about the identity conversation. Although chapter 7 is pretty good. How do we make the hardest conversations safer? So there are some things here which you can kind of deploy tactically, but there's no simple just like follow the steps. That being said, this is the natural place where like the conversation around communication is going to end up, because as you're talking about decisions to be made and emotions get evolved, eventually those emotions are rooted in these identities that people have. So, man, I don't even know where to start with this one. I guess he's got a couple steps for a successful who are we conversation, where you try to draw out your conversation partner's multiple identities. So I guess, you know, that's one thing, is that you have multiple identities. Maybe they are firmly established. Maybe they're just something that you've, you know, picked up along the way and you didn't even think about. But like drawing that out of the person that you're talking to, trying to make sure everyone is on equal footing and looking for social similarities that already exist. I feel like, you know, that's very general and vague, but seems like a very good idea. Look for the things that you have in common, acknowledge the things that are difficult for other people. And then, you know, there are different steps that they go through throughout here where the people who were on completely opposite sides, when they were able to dig into the identities and figure out like what made the other person uncomfortable about certain things or why they held certain views, and they didn't just like listen with the intention of I'm going to rebut this and share facts and figures, but I'm going to make them feel heard, that there was a level of connection that was made even with people who were on completely opposite ends of the spectrum. I mean, that's natural and it's important, but it also is not easy to do in the culture that we find ourselves in. They talk about how like they had these people together for the study and they made these connections, and then 45 minutes after the study was over, they're back on Facebook sharing posts and, you know, they're back into their old ways. So recognizing that there are certain places where these identity conversations should be held. It should be face-to-face. It should be in person. And essentially, my big takeaway from this is like, don't argue on the internet.
So that's interesting. I was going to bring up that point too. It's like, I think there is a hard divide between, is this digital communication or is this face-to-face communication? And I think that could have been made a lot stronger here. That being said, I think this stuff applies across the board. And one of the things where I think it happens in what we would might consider the throwaway comments, I think a lot.
Yes.
So I will start a sentence with, well, you know, as a blah, right? And like, and whatever that is, well, now I'm either in-grouping you or I'm out-grouping you, right? So you're either you're either in with me or you're somewhere else. Or, you know, I know you're a, right? And you like project onto them what their identity is in that situation, when really in the context of the conversation that we're having or the conflict, maybe it is, they're not thinking about themselves in that way at all. Like they're approaching it from a completely different perspective. So one of the ones that, you know, is most relevant right now because we have little kids, you know, it would be like, well, as a parent, you should. And it's like, well, hold on. Like, as soon as you say as a parent, you're projecting the way you think about parenting on the way this other person thinks about parenting. And you're either in-grouping them or out-grouping them with the parent identity, right? And then you get into the, as the Christian parent, right? Like, well, now, okay, hold on. We just added layer upon layer to that, right? Which, and I think that is the way I think about this is, man, if I can get rid of or think intentionally about those throwaway comments, what I think might be throwaway comments, but they really have a different impact on that receiver. How does that change things like stereotype threat? How does that change the way we approach these conversations? How does that level the playing field and put us all on the, you know, on the same level? I think parity would probably be the right word, but that way we can have that conversation. The last thing I'll say, like that I really liked about this chapter, that my wife being a counselor, it made me think about it, but like motivational interviewing. So the way it's described is counselors rarely attempt to convince or persuade. Instead, the counselor subtly guides the client to think about and verbally express their own reasons for or against a change or for or against something. And I think that's a really good way to approach, especially in a conflict situation. So therefore, I'm not going to try to convince you of anything, but man, I'm going to ask you as many questions as I can to try to get you to unpack why you are for a thing and why you're against a thing, because you're going to then tell me all the stuff that I would assume if I don't do that. I have to, like, the only other way to do it is I have to assume. So then when you start telling me, well, as a, right, well, now you said it, not me. Like, I didn't put you in any kind of camp. You told me from what perspective you're approaching this as. And now I understand you better. And I say, oh, well, in this situation, this identity rules, right? Okay, or it's higher than the other ones. And I can see where that perspective would come from. So I agree with you. I think this is one of the hardest chapters to work through. And I think this sits as a fog sounds too ominous. Like, what? I mean, help me figure it out. This is like the air that exists in the room when we're having conversation, and especially we're having conflicts, is like, this is always there. Yeah. Just like emotions are always there. And we always have to think about this stuff, but I don't think we do it. I don't think we do it very often. We just throw away comments too much.
Yeah. I don't know that I have a metaphor for you, but you're right. Like, this is always there. And I don't know that you always need to poke it. A couple things that stood out to me from this. You were talking about the identity threat, and that was one of my big takeaways from this, is that people are made uncomfortable when a speaker says something that lumps the listener into a group against their will. So I don't have an action item associated with that specifically, but I could theoretically have one that's like, make sure you're making a conscious effort not to do that. Because I feel like that against their will is the real important part there. And you were kind of hitting on that. If they identify like, this is who I am and why I believe this way, like, that's totally different than me projecting it onto people. Then there is this motivational interviewing, which this is kind of the technique that the doctor used when having the conversations about people. And they shared, you know, just one anecdotal anecdotal story, but there was somebody who was just like completely anti this particular vaccine. And he just went into it. Motivational interviewing, he says, is guiding the client to verbally express their own reasons for and against change. So this person was saying, you know, they put all this stuff in it and it's going to kill me. And like, oh, so your health is very important to you, obviously, you know, and just getting him to talk about like the reasons why he had the stance that he did. Wasn't trying to convince him. And then he went back later and realized the guy was still in the office. He's like, what's up with that guy? And they're like, oh, well, he opted to get the vaccine. So I feel like that's the thing, is like, don't force this on anybody. Let them reach their own conclusions. And the minute that you start trying to force people to do something, that is the path to misery. Like, that sounds awful. Like, if that is what your definition of success is based on, is being able to convince people via facts and figures, like, to make certain decisions, that's just not going to happen. But like, the minute that he was like, okay, I'm not going to change this guy's mind, and just started talking to him, that's when he was actually able to make progress there. Yeah. But there are times when you do have to draw a line too. So like, one of the stories they tell in this section is about it wasn't the CEO, somebody at high up at Netflix though.
Yeah, I forget, chief marketing officer or something. I forget what it was.
Yeah. And Netflix has this culture, which was always like, make mistakes fast and say whatever the heck you're thinking. And so he used a term that he should not have used and alienated a bunch of people in the room, and that kind of blew things up, and they had continual conversations. Eventually he gets fired. They hire somebody else to come in and like fix things. But there's online, there's this Netflix culture deck, which I need to find this, because that's one of my actions. I want to go through this. I want to see what's actually in there. And I want to take a look at the changes that were made there, because the company culture stuff is interesting to me. That was one of the things that I worked on at the day job. One of the things we really tried to dial in was like, how do we actually live out these values on a group scale? And I think there are certain things that you can do to make them more tangible, and we made some progress in that particular area. But the big takeaway is like, just because you say something is a value doesn't mean that it automatically gets lived out. And you got to think through like, what are the ways that value can be used negatively? And then you can paint a picture of like, well, this is actually what it looks like to do this in a positive sense. Like, one of the ones that stands out to me is like radical candor, because that's one of the things I think they talk about in the Netflix culture deck too, is like the CEO Reed Hastings, like, you could tell him off and tell him he's stupid and this is a dumb decision, and he'll be like, thank you for your feedback, you know. There's good aspects to that, and then there's bad aspects to that. And the bad aspects came out when they all of a sudden found themselves in a situation where, you know, someone was using words that they shouldn't. in this meeting. And it wasn't like they were saying it about the people in the meeting, but just like, you don't use that word.
Yeah.
So it's really complicated, but I also find it kind of fascinating, weirdly. So
help me, Mike, because there's something that rubs me a little bit the wrong way about the structure or the way he unpacks this book. And it didn't really crystallize for me until chapter 7, until the Netflix example, where the connection between the examples and then the points he wanted to make, it wasn't that any of them were bad. It was a matter of, like, I didn't always think it flowed really, really well. We've read books in the past where it's like, it just makes sense. It's like, oh yeah, that example ties right to that point. That example ties right to that point. And I just didn't get that same impression, feel. I don't know what word I want to say there, but it's like, and then it really hit home with this one. It was like this Netflix story is an interesting story. How do I fit it into hard conversations and the points I want to make with hard conversations? And I think I've said this when I've reviewed, like when we've done the show on other books, I really like the stuff that he outlines for hard conversations, the guidelines for hard conversations, questions to ask yourself before beginning a conversation, right? Like all of that, very actionable, makes sense to me, seems very valuable to me. And then it was like mixed in with this Netflix conversation that I just didn't feel fit. Like it was okay, but it just felt like I was wasting pages. And it was like, why? Like why? Like I don't need this much detail about that. And I don't know what I want from you right now, I guess, in this conversation as we're trying to figure out what we're doing here. But it's like, it just didn't sit right with me. And I didn't know. Did you have the same impression or did it sit better with you and it's just a me thing?
Well, I guess I could relate a little bit to the scenario. Not that exact same thing happened to me, but I could empathize with the setting a little bit. And I feel like you tell that story, there has to be a whole lot of detail that's added because there's a whole bunch of nuance. And I think at this point, it's a little bit out of place because, yeah, this is like the deepest level. This is where you got to know how this stuff works if you find yourself in one of these identity conversations. But it's also kind of the information in here is sort of presented in a way like, okay, so here's what you do if you end up here, but maybe you don't want to go here all the time. Like in the guide to using these ideas, there's the before a discussion, ask yourself, and it's what are your hopes? How will you start? What obstacles might emerge? If those obstacles appear, what's the plan? And then what are the benefits of this dialogue? And I think it's very possible that you go through that and the obstacles are plenty and the benefits are few.
Yes, yes.
So yeah. At that point, you're just like, you know what? Let's not do this one.
Yep.
So yeah, it is a little bit awkward. And this is where like I feel having some sort of pyramid diagram or like a stack diagram where you've got the different levels of the conversation instead of these are the three different types of conversation maybe helps. Because if you say, yeah, this is the one that you're not going to talk about the most very often, but it's going to be the most important when you do, like you really don't want to mess this one up because the stakes are so high. Maybe that changes the tone a little bit. But yeah, like if you're just looking at that Netflix example, there's a whole bunch of detail that's being added there because you don't want this guy made one mistake and he didn't really mean it the way that it came across. And like, you don't want to paint this guy as an evil jerk. So you need to now use a whole bunch of words to communicate a different message.
Yeah.
But then it's complicated.
Like it was such a stark example. That's a great way to think about it. Like it was such a stark example that like you launch in with that and then you're trying to figure out what's the point. What's the rest of the chapter? When the rest of the chapter is really good. I think the rest of the chapter stands really well on its own. We didn't need that big punch to start out chapter 7. So that's good. That helped me. Thanks. That helped me process through why that sat funny with me.
Yeah, you maybe don't need that story, but on the other hand, like maybe you do need that story. Like that's kind of his style, is he's got these stories and then he talks about the points. And I feel like if you're going to include any sort of story, I don't know how you have a story that illustrates the point about these like really deep rooted issues that could come up in these conversations and these meetings where typically this stuff is like taboo. And then like, how do you actually talk about this? I feel like it was a useful piece of the message that he's trying to convey in these sections. But yeah, it does take a long time, and add to the fact that it's really uncomfortable. Like you do get to the point where you're like, okay, let's move on now.
Yeah, exactly. Can I give my two-liner on the afterword?
And sure.
Then you can. The afterword was fine. The link is intimate discussions, better relationships, more happiness. And I was like, okay, we're good. Check that box. I just didn't feel, you know, like I don't know whether it just didn't resonate with me, but I was kind of like, okay, this makes sense.
Well, again, the story here is fascinating. So he talks about this study that was canceled at Harvard after they had a bunch of years into it, where they were basically following these people around and figuring out what would make them successful salespeople, because it was sponsored by this big business guy and he wanted to use it as like a filtering program for hiring, and they needed the money. So they're like, yeah, let's do this study. And then somebody there stumbles upon this research, you know, 20 years after they canceled it, and decides to look these people up, find out if they're still successful or not. That reminded me a lot of a book that we covered previously. I think this was the one that Joe had picked before he had to step away for a while. So it was really weird. It was The Good Life, and I had to do it solo.
Yeah. I remembered this one too. And I was like, I wonder if this is the same study from The Good Life.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think it is, but that's what it reminded me of. Like same sort of principle. It's like, well, let's figure out what really makes, you know, people successful. And there's two big takeaways here. The most important thing, most important part of flourishing they found from the people that they checked in on is whether they have a sense of love, and really it's relationships. The people who were miserable are the ones who had a negative sense of relationships. So this is uncomfortable to me as an introvert, but I kind of knew this already, having read enough of these books. Like, relationships are important. So you need to cultivate these, whether you like people or not. It's kind of a joke at our house, is like, my wife is very extroverted, I am very introverted. And so this kind of this point of tension, she always wants to go out and do stuff with other people. I'm just like, no, give me a book.
Yeah.
But you know, before COVID hit, we had read The Art of Gathering by Priya Parker. And I forget, there was one other thing that kind of spearheaded this, but Nir Eyal, talked about in Indistractable. He talked about this concept of the kibbutz, where they would have these other couples over and the kids would go play together and the adults would have share a meal together, and then they'd have an intentional conversation. So Rachel and I were like, you know, I like to show up places and ask deep questions and make people uncomfortable. She likes to hang out with people, so we could combine those things. And so we did that. We bought new furniture for our living room and kind of laid it out differently so that we could facilitate that sort of thing. And we did that right before COVID happened, and then it got shut down. But that was like one of my things from one of my personal retreats, was like, we got to figure out ways to build these intentional relationships.
Yeah.
The intentional relationships hit way different with me. You know, just being around people at a surface level, like, that's very draining to the introverted me. But if I can really make a deep connection, like, it kind of transforms the experience. So like, this was a different way of hitting on some of those, a reminder, I guess, of those things that I had learned a while back. But I think like the way he says it so succinctly in those two different points is really well done. And then in terms of like, okay, so the book is over, what are you going to do about this? There's no like, okay, this is what you do next sort of a thing. But the big takeaway I feel that is communicated in the afterword, and I think is very effective, is that achieving connection is the most important thing in life. He actually says that verbatim in this afterword, and I feel like that's very important, and that is why you should read the book. Honestly, that's the case for everything that he just laid out there, and it's kind of cool to see the evolution here. You know, I mentioned at the beginning he shares how he was struggling with this stuff, and he's like, I better figure out how to do this. That kind of resonated with me because that's sort of how I became a writer for the internet. It's like, I want to write. I don't know how to write. I guess I better write. You know, I better understand the process. And that's why I like creativity is and productivity is such a big deal to me. You can kind of see the growth as he goes through these different steps. And then it all culminates as to like, this is the most important thing that you can possibly do. And I do think that's true. I don't think that's an overstatement. I remember reading something by Chris Bailey. I think it may be the Productivity Project. And at the end of that, he talks about how people are the reason for productivity. Really, like, the most important thing is people. And that's a really important concept that everybody's got to get at some point, even if you're introverted like I am, and you generally just don't like being around, quote unquote, people, like large groups. There are certain people, individuals that you need to form these strong connections with, that's going to make your life a lot better.
I don't know. I think we've wrapped it. I think we did a good job.
All right. Awesome. So let's go to action items. I got a couple links to grab and a couple timestamps to enter. So I'm going to let you go first, if that's okay, for action items.
That's no problem. So what I want to do is I want to look at the 36 questions. You said you found them. So I want to find the 36. I want to look through those. I won't go as far as to say I'm going to encourage and or force someone to do these questions with me. But what I will say is, Mike, I would probably, I know, let me look at them first, but I'll probably be up for like a member special for, you know, going through these and seeing where it goes. The next thing I want to do is I want to pay attention to throwaway comments in my conversations that I have, right? Am I making these throwaway comments, especially around identity, right? So am I making these throwaway comments, and can I notice that, and can I figure out a way to, do that less? So that might be in my teaching, that might be in individual conversations I have with family and friends or colleagues, whatever that might be. Those are my two action items from this book.
Cool. All right. I've got three. The first one is from the first section, and I mentioned this already, but the do you want to be helped, hugged, or heard? I don't think I'm going to use those terms with everybody. Maybe I need to think of a different way to ask that question in a more professional setting, but those terms specifically, I think, would be helpful in my conversations with my wife. So I want to like explicitly ask that. And really even deeper than that here is kind of define the shared language so that we can use this together when we communicate to make our communication more effective. I also want to, I put rephrase common questions to spark deep conversation. That was the way I worded it in my mind map file in the section on the how do we feel conversation. This is from the same chapter as those 36 fast friends method questions. So it's not like specifically taking those and asking those in conversations, but really it's taking like the conversations I would normally ask when I'm in a social situation, like, hey, what do you do for a living? That kind of stuff. How do I change those so that they open up to a little bit deeper level? I don't have a lot of opportunity to practice this necessarily, but it's just something I want to be thinking about. And really, I think that's the win, is like trying to go deeper when I find myself in those situations without making it awkward, because that's what I do. And then check out the Netflix culture deck. Thank you. You put the note in or the link to that already. So I saw this on their website, and I haven't looked at this one specifically, but I do want to see this versus the old version. So yes. I want to see the differences between these, and that'll take a little bit of digging, but the Wayback Machine may be involved here, but we'll find that out.
their culture deck was simultaneously intriguing to me and then frightening at the same time, because I was like, yeah, man, that sounds so freeing. And I was like, man, that's going to go so bad. Like, that's just going to go so wrong in so many ways.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
All right. Style and rating. My book, I'll go first. I feel like this is the Charles Duhigg redemption story for me. I really like this book. I feel like you can see the models played out here. I mean, if you're looking for fodder to make fun of your standard productivity book, it's in here. You've got the 2x2 grids. You've got the wheels. And there's lots of them. Like, there's he leveraged every opportunity to create simple diagrams around the points that he was making. And it can be a little bit clumsy to figure out how they all link or tie together. I feel like you got to view some of them in isolation, but I feel the main model, which is the one that doesn't have a graphic associated with it of the three different conversations, is really powerful.
All you had to do was make three parts.
Yeah. Well, he kind of did the three parts based on the conversations, but there's no visual in terms of like how these go together. And I feel like, as we've talked about, there is kind of a natural escalation. Yeah. So choose the model you want to use, whether you're going higher, whether you're going deeper. But I mean, there are different levels to this, which is begging for that visual. I don't think that necessarily detracts from the book at all. I feel like the topic is super important. I feel like it is very loosely tied to the topic of emotional intelligence, and there is an opportunity to go deeper, but I don't really care that he didn't. I feel like just these different levels of conversation and how to navigate and flow between them is very important. But also, I don't know what exactly I was expecting, but not what I was expecting. I can tell you that. I figured this was going to be more like tactical, when you're in a meeting and to get people on your side, do this. Maybe it's because we just read a Robert Greene book, and that's very much how those tend to go. But I feel like this is a really good book. I feel like it's really understandable. I feel like the stories are really good. I feel like just about everybody could benefit from reading this. I mean, you don't have to be in a corporate setting, and you got to learn to navigate back and forth with this stuff, although it's definitely useful in that situation. It's not just for improving relationships at home, but like, since everything that we do really is tied to other people in some way, shape, or form, this is a book that if you really understood this, and I feel like if you took this to heart, this would absolutely make your communication better in just about any area of life. So I'm going to recommend this one to just about everybody. I don't think, like, I didn't read this book and was like, oh my gosh, this was completely life-changing. Like, I did have to work for the insight and revelation that I got from this. I'll just say that. There are some books I pick up and they just click, and they're like, yeah, you're speaking my language. And, you know, I read through it in 24 hours and feels like 15 minutes. You know, that wasn't this book. So I'm going to rate it at 4 stars. As much as I like shared all the like really good stuff that comes out of it, I do feel like you do got to put in a little bit of work with this one. I do think it's worth it. I think the topic is awesome. I really like the way that Charles Duhigg approached this one. I'm going to pick up the next Charles Duhigg book after reading this one. So, I mean, if you had to pick, you know, it's probably between a 4 and a 5 for me, but I just don't feel like it gets to 5-star territory. It's hard to describe like the feeling that you get when you walk away from a 5-star book. It just hits different. And this one didn't. This one was like, I'm glad that I read that. This is really useful. I enjoyed it. But okay, on to the next thing.
Yeah.
You know, so 4 stars.
Yeah. So I'll give the end first. 4 stars as well. So I'm right where you were. I think the last comment you made summarizes my thinking very, very well. I'm really glad I read this book. I actually think I'm going to use a lot of the concepts in this book moving forward, and I'm going to experiment with them, and I'm going to figure out, are they effective and how are they effective and how do they incorporate into my natural style of communicating with other people? At face value, I think all of the stuff made a lot of sense, and it was backed by, you know, good examples or research or things that weren't just, you know, somebody sitting down and just making up a bunch of stories and writing those there. I think my knock tends to be, I felt like some of the stories or some of the examples were a little bit forced to end there. And I actually have very little, if any, qualms with the kind of like the core concepts or the content from the, this is how to communicate effectively in emotional situations and in factual situations and in practical and all that. I didn't really have any issues with that. Mine was more so the stories that attach to that. And then like you described really, really well, I walked out of it going, okay, good. And I didn't walk out of it with that, like, man, that was a great book. If people want to a good book to read, and or if they're thinking about communication and how to communicate better, I will definitely recommend this to them. But it's not going to be one that, like, randomly I'll just walk up to people and be like, you know what you should read? You should read Super Communicators, right? Where there are other books where I would definitely do that. So I'm in agreement. 4 stars. Mike, or what's our next upcoming book? I guess it's mine, so I'll start. We're going to read Why We Sleep by Matt Walker. And I'm actually really, really glad you encouraged me to pick this one, because last episode you encouraged me to pick this one. I listened to Matt Walker talk about sleep on the Andrew Huberman podcast, and he's kind of going through this guest series with it. And I'm actually excited to read this book now, right? So he isn't describing the book. They're actually just talking about sleep from a whole different perspective. But like hearing him talk about it and just the way he unpacks different things, I'm pretty jazzed to read this book. And I think it's going to be a really interesting book for us. So what's yours?
Awesome. Yeah, I'm looking forward to Why We Sleep also. The book I am picking is Super Thinking by Gabriel Weinberg and Lauren McCann. I talked to you about this in, I guess it wasn't the pro show, it was the bootleg. This was a book that's been on my radar for a while. I like the whole concept of mental models, and I discovered recently, because I share an office at the co-working space with a designer for DuckDuckGo, that Gabriel Weinberg, I believe, is the CEO for DuckDuckGo. So my office mate had this book and was asking him about it. He's like, oh yeah, that's the CEO. Oh, interesting. Well, I like DuckDuckGo to begin with. That's my default search engine on my phone. Actually, I don't use Google.
Oh, okay.
So I like the company, but I like mental models more. And if you combine those things, like, maybe this is a good book. It's going to be a big one though. So I asked you about it, like, hey, are you cool with me picking this one? It's like 350 pages. We're getting into Robert Greene territory again.
Heck yeah.
But 350 pages about mental models. Yes, please sign me up.
Yep.
All right. Got any gap books?
So I feel as though I'm doing the podcast a disservice. I feel as though if you're going to talk about liminal thinking, I'm familiar with liminal thinking because I probably listened to the Bookworm episode on liminal thinking, but I've not read liminal thinking. So I need to read Liminal Thinking. That way I can connect with you on a level that just makes sense. So I'm going to read Liminal Thinking. That's my gap book.
So Corey's going to super communicate by reading Liminal Thinking. I love it. Yeah, that's a good one. Glad you're reading it. I actually had that thought of, like, maybe we should record Liminal Thinking again. And you and I just talk about it.
Yeah.
All right, I got a gap book. It's Smart Brevity by Jim Vandehay, Mike Allen, and Roy Schwartz. So Smart Brevity is a very prescriptive way to communicate on the internet with written text. And I don't think I'm going to do the exact thing, but I think the principles that they talk about there are really, really good. I'm most of the way done with this one. I got a couple chapters left. Very easy read. Anyone who communicates with words, I feel like should read this. All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode. I want to say thank you to the Bookworm supporters. We have a Patreon now, $7 a month. If you support the show, you get our undying gratitude. We really appreciate it. It helps keep the lights on. And you get a couple of perks for that. You get a 4K wallpaper. You get access to a couple of private feeds. One is the bootleg feed, which gets uploaded right after we record. So that has all of the stumblings and you know, all the mistakes that we made are still in there, but you get access to the episode about a week and a half to 2 weeks before it actually comes out. You also get a pro feed, which is the edited show with a extra section. And today we talked about the Vision Pro and where we see that technology fit in, because I got a chance to demo one when I was in Kansas City. And though that gets released the day before the regular show, that show also, when we have ads, has the ads removed. So a couple of perks there. But if you are interested in supporting the show, you can go to patreon.com/bookwormfm. I think that's the right URL. Did I get that right, Corey?
Okay, that's correct. Cool.
All right. So thanks, everyone, for listening along. And if you're reading along with us, pick up Why We Sleep by Matt Walker, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.